We're going to reconvene the Interim Committee on Public Health, and we are going to deal with safe drinking water. Susan Allen, would you come up, please? Gail Shibley? Dave Leland?
I believe Dave Leland is not here, at least. I'm not sure that...
Hey, Matt? No?
Linda Fleming? Linda, are you doing...
Well, whoever is going to testify with you in this first session, if you would all please get to the table, that would be good.
Please, if you would.
Okay, that's fine.
And for the record.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, and we'll get started.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director in the Department of Human Services.
I'm Michael Kurtz. I live in Kaiser, Oregon. I work for a local government called Suburban East Salem Water District and manage their water system for them.
And Gail Shibley will be joining us shortly. I think she's doing sprints in the hallway because there was a little confusion about her PowerPoint. And she's the main part of the show. But I'll take, while she's collecting herself, the opportunity to introduce safe drinking water.
Here comes the late Gail Shibley. No.
I said you were doing wind sprints to work up to this.
Gail, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a delight to be here. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services, the Division of Public Health. You may recall that I made a mention of drinking water and our needs and responsibilities when I was here before you January 18th. And you very kindly followed up on that and asked that we come back and provide more information. So that's exactly what we're doing today. A couple words. One, a county supervising sanitarian had every intention of being here. He and I worked very closely together to put this presentation together and frankly, a bunch of other presentations and discussions, and he has been a true leader in terms of environmental public health in Oregon. Matt Jackwa is actually in Yamhill Hill County doing his job dealing with a food outbreak. So he sends his regrets, and I know that he would much rather be here, but he belongs there right now. Linda Fleming, of course, the executive director of the Conference of Local Health Officials, has been extremely supportive and helpful as we try to coordinate all the local health departments to work together as part of one single drinking water system. And last but not least at all, I'm absolutely delighted that Michael Kurtz was able to join us today. Mr. Kurtz is the manager of East Salem Water District. It serves about 12,000 folks there. They buy actually finished water from the city of Salem, so he does not treat water, but he distributes it and is likewise a very critical part of a statewide system. He also, we've tapped him, no pun intended, for his knowledge and leadership, and is part of our administratively constructed Drinking Water Advisory Committee. Okay. He tells me that he started with the East Salem Water District in 1972, so he was in kindergarten at the time, and he has grown up with the program and with the responsibilities and just a tremendous resource for us, and he's made himself available here today as well.
Good. Thank you.
So very simply put, drinking water. What is it? Where do we get it? How safe is it? What do we need, and what are we going to do about it?
Is it supposed to be showing?
Oh, if Patsy? I press the right button.
Oh. Okay. Sorry, I thought it was behind me all the time. I apologize. There we go. Thank you very much, Patsy.
You're alive.
So just some very fundamental questions. I will literally race through this. Please stop me, as you know, anytime. I'm happy to provide answers either immediately or in more depth. Later on. Who cares about drinking water? Well, one, the public cares. The legislature cares. And the executive branch cares, certainly Public Health Division and even the mission of DHS is all about helping people become independent, healthy, and safe. So where do we get this water that we serve to millions of people? We get it from three different broad categories. One, the public water systems. That's the tap water, and that serves about 3 million people around the state. And that comes in kind of two different sizes. 25 or more people, systems that serve 25 or more people are regulated or are under the regulations established by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Those that serve 10 to 24 people are not regulated under federal regulations, but they are included in what I called out ORS 448, what we call state-regulated systems. More on that later. So that's the water that I want to talk with you about today. Of course, other sources of water, individual household wells, we don't know how many those are. We guesstimate that there are about 600,000 of them. And, of course, bottled water, a large business served as a beverage.
So now, I'm sorry, and Charles probably knows the answer to this. If you drill a well, you need permission from the water master to put a well down. And do you have to have it? You have to have it tested then, right, for safe water, or do you?
You do not have to do anything. I mean, really? In terms of public health, Water Resources Department probably has something to say about it. There are other agencies of the state, but within public health, no. Of course, when real estate transactions occur and somebody sells a farm or a house out in the country that's on a well, that information, of course, is included in the real estate transfer documents. We get copies of those, frankly, but we have no capacity, frankly, to enter that system in, or enter all that information into a database.
Okay.
And so because we don't regulate them anyway.
The water is safe. The assumption. No.
No.
Oh.
We don't know.
Oh, okay. okay.
So the public water systems, I just want to give you a couple snapshots, a couple different lenses to look through as we talk about this tap water throughout Oregon. As you notice, we've got a lot of those EPA systems, about 22,700 EPA water systems around the state. That's a lot of systems. About another 1,000 that serve that 10 to 24 people that I mentioned before, the so-called state systems. And it breaks out like that. And by size, those 2,699 EPA water systems, what sizes are those? Well, only four of them serve 100,000 or more people. 86% of those EPA systems serve fewer than 500 people. Mike Kurtz actually has a big water system. He's a large water system under the federal definition because he serves more than 10,000 people. A different kind of level of regulation that accrues to that. So where do we get this water? Well, we get it from the ground and we get it from the surface. Lakes, rivers, or groundwater wells and springs. Very important difference to note here. 90% of the water systems rely on groundwater, but 75% of the population get their tap water from surface water. So what's out there in that water? Well, these we kind of put together as kind of the sickening six. by our experience and expertise, they're about in appropriate order. Microbials, those are the various types of bugs in the water. Lead, disinfection byproducts, and actually Mike can probably tell you all about these much better than I ever could. But we put chlorine in the water to treat it, but then there are some repercussions of that. Inorganic chemicals. Nitrate is an enormous issue in some parts of the state. Arsenic, also big in many parts of the state. Organic chemicals and naturally occurring and otherwise radiological sources. We don't have a lot of radon, but where it is, it's a problem. Uranium, etc. Where do they come from? They come from everywhere. And I wanted to see if I can grab a pointer to share with you that just as we talk about source to tap, You know, if the source is polluted, you're going to get, you know, have to deal with polluted water, garbage in, garbage out. Landslides, runoff, increased turbidity, pesticides, herbicides, etc. And farther down that system, of course, is the treatment of the water. And the system could fail, treatment chemicals, byproducts, even the materials and coatings that are used in all the pumps and the basins and so on. Then we get down to the water system distribution. Well, the pipe could break, storage tank could leak. Mike could probably provide only too many real-life examples of that. Then you'd think if you jumped through all those hurdles, you'd be home safe. But you're not necessarily, because at home you've got cross connections, plumbing materials, frankly most of the lead in drinking water at the tap comes from the plumbing materials in the home, not, of course, in the distribution system or the finished water. So how do we protect that drinking water? Well, we got to protect it source to tap, exactly where these contaminants come from. Dealing with and assessing the vulnerability of and protecting source water, making sure that water treatment is reliable, protecting the distribution system of the finished water, making sure that people who operate and maintain and manage those systems have the expertise and competence and assistance they need to do that day in, day out, 24 hours a day. And last but not least, public information and outreach so that folks know, for example, how to flush their tap for lead, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I know you probably, this is included in this, but in my district, we have Warwick Lake,
mm-hmm.
Where people drink, that's their water out of the lake. Most of the homes around there have sewage tanks. These are lovely homes. These are not small little cabins. And I'm amazed that people will buy land in Oregon with no water system because they don't have a city, a water system. 10 Mile Lake,
mm-hmm.
They've been taking water out of 10 Mile for years. They also have sewage tanks. It's highly suspect to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I hear you. I know actually both those lakes fairly well. 10 Mile Lake, as you may know, we had a public health advisory on that lake for quite some time, actually. Although it's not my area of expertise, I believe it's accurate to say that basically every drop of water in a basin is owned by somebody. The right to that water is owned by somebody, and you need, in order to put a pipe in a lake like Wohink or others, you need to make sure that you've got the water rights to do that, and that's through the Water Resources Department. The health of that water, well, if they do not come under public health regulation, we have no way, A, of knowing that they even exist, and B, certainly no way to oversee or assist or enforce any health standards related to those.
Follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair. There were no water rights held by anyone that was building around Wohink Lake, and so now they have gotten water rights through Dune City. It's a very complicated situation at Wohink Lake, but where it comes to water, it really bothers me because we have, in my district, lots of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always being used like I think that we should mm-hmm. use it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, it really is true that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting, and that's certainly true. As actually a native of Coos County, I'm only too familiar with some of the tussles there. It's no consolation to know that those same kinds of contentions happen absolutely everywhere, and maybe even especially where there's not very much water. And I can certainly understand where you have a lot of water, seemingly everybody ought to be able to get their share.
Mm-hmm. Now, does DEQ, where do they come in?
That's a great question, and what a great lead-in. The drinking water system really is a network, a chain, of course, and we need to make sure that every single piece of that is just as strong and healthy as possible. Of course, the public water systems themselves, their responsibility is to provide safe water. It's not the state's responsibility. It's not a distributor responsibility. It's not a treatment responsibility. It's not the laboratory's responsibility. It's not EPA's responsibility. It is the water system, the regulated system. The labs, of course, play an extremely important role in helping analyze and report the results of the monitoring that's required. EPA sets those minimum public health standards. State and local public health work arm in arm to assure that those minimum standards are met. You know that I mentioned source to tap. Source water assessment and source water protection is something that we, public health, have contracted with DEQ to leverage their expertise when it comes to environmental vulnerabilities and impacts. And so you may recall that Stephanie Halleck was here in January. It's literally part of her water division that we contract with to help with source water protection. And we have now done assessments on all the drinking water, all the large systems, I think, maybe 10,000 and over systems in the state, and are working with communities as they are requesting it to assist them to protect their sources. We have extremely limited resources. We cannot do it proactively. We can't even respond as well as we'd like to, but that's the idea behind it.
May I interrupt, Mr. Chair, to give a compliment to the work that Gail in particular has been doing with her program. What you just asked a minute ago acknowledges that our piece of getting safe water into people's homes or into their glasses is only the end stage that requires a lot of other players. Gail and her program have really reached out to find ways to cooperate and to see it as one big system with several other departments, DEQ in particular. That's still a work in progress because everyone is stretched thin. But that's, I would say, one of the good parts of the story she's telling. She's shortly getting to what are not such pretty parts to this story. But one of the good things is the cooperation with DEQ.
Now, I've been thinking about the Springfield Utility Board. The city of Springfield does not do water or electricity. That's a separate board, elected board, and we use wells, but we're running out of well water, so we're going to start trying to use the McKinsey River, which Eugene has water rights to.
Mm-hmm.
I remember them coming to us when I was on the council and mayor with maps of the wells, and they had circles drawn around designating, and I think these were for commercial industrial developments, because if very minute particles of the wrong material gets into the well, that will wipe out the well. And so now, was that a DEQ? That must have been a DEQ.
Mr. Chair, I'm just smiling from my head to my toes. That is exactly what we have been working with DEQ,
okay,
to make that available to communities just like Springfield.
Yeah.
Okay, now they do, okay, so they're doing a health environmental scan as well as environmental, well.
They're doing, Mr. Chair, if I may, actually, I think it's more accurate rather than saying they, it's we all, because it's not just that we contract with them and then go away and they do it all by themselves.
Yeah.
We work with them literally every day, every hour,
yeah,
back and forth.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we certainly don't do any biomonitoring. We don't do any individual health risk assessments.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is take a look at the specific uniquenesses of that source of drinking water. If it's a surface water, for example, we look at that watershed, look at land uses and developments upland from that, you know, certainly any known contaminants, naturally occurring or otherwise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we also take a look at what type of soil and approximately how long it would take, you know, to move water from point A to point B. And that's far above my technical expertise, but suffice it to say that it is a very thorough, in-depth environmental assessment, not an individual human health assessment.
But it encompasses health. I mean, the purpose of it is health.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, that's why it's important that we work literally hand in glove with DEQ. They have an expertise about what happens in the environment. Translating that information into what the health risks might be is our piece of the conversation. So they do the external measures, and then we're responsible for the health message and assessment piece of that with them.
So you notice that EPA sets these standards. Well, why do they set the standards? They do it for three, if three pieces are met. If the contaminant does something bad to human health and it happens often enough or at high a dosage enough to be of a health concern and regulating, we can actually do something about it. And so looking at those three screens, if you will, the U.S. EPA currently regulates 91 contaminants. This is a chart of our reality in terms of the number of contaminants. 76 was Mike, help me out. Let's see. When EPA, I think, was founded in 74, and I think 76, there were you know, clearly about 21 standards. And were there any before that?
There's always been a few since I've been associated, since 1972.
Would you identify yourself?
Michael Kurtz, Suburban East Salem Water District.
Thank you.
The chlorine residuals and coliform tests have always gone on. And then there's been for testing of sources, which we don't do, nitrates and things like that. But there weren't that many originally.
Right. Members of the committee, if I were good enough at PowerPoint, I would have done a dotted line up right here. And here's why. Kind of like the Ginsu knife commercial, here's what we're looking at today. But wait, there's more. We have one standard already out as of the end of 2005. We have three more that the EPA has told us will be out by the end of 2006. But wait, there's more. In the years ahead, EPA is already talking with the states about radon, protecting distribution systems, also emerging contaminants, and there are a passel of them. So the reality is that we've got an enormous workload, and it ain't going away. It's going just the opposite direction.
Now, is Homeland Security involved in this?
Mr. Chair, the U.S. EPA provides about $50,000 a year for assistance and outreach to water systems for vulnerability assessments. Now, $50,000 a year for 2,699 public water systems, you know, yeah. Is that your answer?
Well, okay. There are some cities that have open reservoirs that are in the middle of a park.
And no, really?
Right, yeah. And I know that there's a lot of pressure to cover them and so on and so forth. So these are issues. I mean, obviously. Okay.
You're right, Mr. Chair. They are issues. How safe is Oregon's drinking water? Well, the good news is it's safer than it was.
Yes.
Could we go back to your question and a follow-up? Again, looking at the Homeland Security fees, what is the coordination with Homeland Security or the Office of Emergency Management around the issue of keeping our drinking water safe, especially in those places where it would appear that there's great exposure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, this is something that major cities across the country are doing under a couple of umbrellas required by Homeland Security. Those cities which are funded with what's called Urban Area Security Initiative money, or UASI money, a part of that is actually an infrastructure safety and assessment process. So in this state, that really just applies to the larger metropolitan Portland area, the four-county region plus Clark County in Washington State. Those areas have, under their emergency management responsibilities, that their emergency managers are required to do these assessments, required to have monitoring and safety response plans. Outside of that area, there are models and guidance. There's neither funding nor an obligation that I'm aware of beyond that. I would need to double-check with the State Office of Emergency Management. As far as I know, the only activity really pushing this has been in the greater Portland metro area, and that otherwise its information has been provided to the rest of the state. I'm not sure whether you have any additional information from
yes,
the Salem area.
Mr. Chair and fellow committee members, if I might. Suburbia Salem Water District was required to do an emergency preparedness plan and to do assessments on our distribution system and any water critical components that we had. And I believe that systems as small as 3,300 population also had to do the same thing. May not be as comprehensive as some of the larger systems, but there was coordination with Homeland Security on preparing those, or at least EPA in preparing the plans.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
May I request, and I'm speaking now also to our chair of the joint, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Emergency Preparedness Committee, that we flag this issue as one that we need to take a look at through our full committee's work, and perhaps it's something that is being looked at through the subcommittees. I'm just not aware of it.
Mr. Chair, if I may address kind of a relative risk point that may be of help to the committee. I was involved in my previous job quite extensively in drinking water security as well as emergency preparedness in the National Capital Region around Washington, D.C., and had the opportunity to spend time with national experts looking at the question of possible terrorist assaults or, in fact, accidental assaults, but particularly terrorist assaults on drinking water systems. It's not an inconsequential risk, but relative to the risk that Gail is proceeding to talk about is actually remarkably difficult. The dilution factors and the access factors, again, it's not impossible, but the majority of risk actually comes from accidental contamination or failure of systems rather than from the likelihood of someone deliberately contaminating. So I certainly would support being part of a general widespread assessment. I do think that relative to a number of other emergency risks and health risks, including the current struggles of our system in this state, you may find that the experts will tell you that that's one you could put on your second-tier list.
So, Mr. Chair,
I guess one that we need to consciously be aware of, I think that's what we're doing right here. Mm-hmm. It's rising up to our conscious level. I think we're all aware of the accidental stuff that goes on, or inadvertent dumping sewage into the lake. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be inadvertent, but I mean it's.
Mr. Chair, Gail Shibley again. We are also state and very soon local public health departments are finalizing a drinking water emergency response plan, along with food and radiation and chem and on and on. And of course, those will be followed up with exercises and trainings and after actions and, you know, revisions and so on. But clearly, it's one thing to respond; it's another thing to prevent. And I appreciate your concern about shoring up potential vulnerabilities. If I may, right now, today, how safe is Oregon's drinking water? Well, the good news is it's safer than it used to be, a lot safer. And frankly, that's because a lot of people did a lot of work. Some of you may recall that about 20 years ago, we couldn't have said that with any degree of veracity. There were, in the 1970s, 15 waterborne outbreaks. And throughout the years, from then till now, more than 7,000 people in Oregon have gotten sick from waterborne outbreaks. You see that as a result of a lot of work by a lot of people at all the points of that chain, we've brought it down. We did that through making sure that operators had at least a base level of knowledge and certifying them. We helped access low-cost federal loans so that communities can build better facilities. And frankly, it just takes smart people on the phone and boots on the ground to work with those 2,699 water systems to make sure they've got the information. So that's the public health staff that needs to, you know, assist, inspect, investigate, inform, and so on. So that's the good news. The reality is, though, that some threats remain. And frankly, the smaller EPA systems don't always meet health standards. Again, there are 91 contaminants. There are more coming. They're becoming more and more complex. Oftentimes, these folks are volunteers or part-time managers. They've got other responsibilities as well. And it's extremely difficult for them. And they need a lot of work. It's not the $400,000 or 100,000 person and above water systems that need the help. It's frankly not even the 10,000 and above. They don't need as much help. It's the 3,300 and below, and particularly those under 500. There is no help for the state-regulated systems. That's the approximately 921, when frankly we just stopped counting. Because we don't have the resources to proactively oversee their operations at all. We respond to their questions. We help them as we would anybody who asks for our help. But frankly, we are not discharging our responsibility under Oregon revised statutes. State county capacity just simply is not sufficient to do that job. We at the state level are unable to adopt those latest EPA standards, and the future standards, those are an enormous question. Specifically, as you may know, the benchmark drinking water is one of the benchmarks in Oregon Progress Board. First, you might notice there was no improvement for 3 years in terms of meeting our benchmark target. And the good news is we meet it in terms of population. 95% of Oregonians drink water that meet health-based standards. That's great. However, if you look at the number of systems, only 84% of the systems actually meet the health-based standards. Again, they're the small systems. They're the systems in every one of the non-urban districts represented by you and your colleagues all around the state. And it's not just us looking at this and being concerned about this. The Secretary of State did an audit in 2000 and came up with a variety of concerns and issues, and we at State Public Health have been working on those ever since. And the Drinking Water Advisory Committee that Mr. Kurtz is a part of has been a really integral part in making sure that we stay focused on those safety-related, public health-related priorities. Basically, the audit found that Oregonians need and deserve stronger drinking water enforcement, need faster response, better oversight of the labs, full adoption of all health standards, and making sure that those on-site inspections are conducted
now,
on time.
These are these EPA, DEQ rules? Are they state rules? Are they feds? What?
Mr. Chair, I am only talking about the federal EPA minimum public health standards. States, of course, are required under primacy to at least adopt the federal minimum standards. Each state can determine if they want to adopt stricter standards.
Okay. Are you saying that we have not been able to even adopt the minimum federal standards, or have we?
Mr. Chair, you may recall that somewhere back around here, these new standards.
Okay.
We, as a state, are requesting from EPA a two-year extension on state adoption of these standards because we simply do not have the time or the people to delve into this complexity. The same is true for the other three. Those are the standards that I'm talking about. The 91, yes, we have adopted those. It's the new ones that, frankly, we simply, there's not another straw that will fit on this camel's back.
Okay. Now, I hate to run government funding by lawsuits, but, you know, we've been nailed for not providing adequate funding for the disabled. We're about to be sued for adequate funding for education, and this looks like another lawsuit in the making if someone chose to go that route.
Mr. Chair, if I can just give you just some examples. These are not all of them, but I wanted to make sure that you had some specifics. The critical functions to assure safe drinking water. Again, we need to make sure that we've got people, technical people out on the ground looking at those 2,699 systems all around the state. They are required, depending on the water source, to be inspected in person every 3 years or every 7 years now. They're moving to every 3 years regardless of water source. And, Mr. Kurtz, when was the last time your water district had an on-site inspection?
1999. So we're on the bubble.
So that was 7 years ago, Mr. Chair, and we're simply not getting it done. Disinfection and filtration of water system took us a decade longer than what was required under the feds to get that done. Reducing the lead levels at the tap, we're still not done. We're committed to getting it done this year, but we simply, by focusing on that, it's ballooning out somewhere else. So I don't want to leave you the impression that somehow we've just been, not paying attention. The communities that meet all the health standards, that benchmark is 94. I mentioned that it's instead 84. Significant non-compliers. These are kind of chronic problem systems for a wide variety of reasons. The standard appropriately is zero. You got a problem, it's persistent, it's a health hazard, fix it. We've got 140 of them. And frankly, that's good. Over the last 2.5 years, we have really focused on significant non-compliers and brought that number down from what it used to be. But we are still about the highest in the West. And then again, adopting these federal standards, you're supposed to adopt them within 2 years. The current standards, yes, we've adopted. The latest, no. And who knows about the future? So what do we have to do to add that capacity? Well, workload just flat out takes more people. We've got, for the existing EPA rules, it's just the 91 contaminants right now, a statewide drinking water task force that frankly was convened by Chair Jensen, Representative Jensen from Eastern Oregon in 2004, identified 11 FTE for specific targeted functions like those that I just showed you on that chart for existing EPA rules. Then for the 2006 EPA rules, the U.S. EPA has estimated 2.5 FTE for that. We believe that that's maybe a little conservative, but we're going with that number. If that's what they say, we'll take it. And then, of course, there are all of the state-regulated system, and I use that in quotes because they are under ORS 448. It's just that nothing's happening with any of those. So approximately another five folks are needed for that based on our work for EPA systems and what it would take to deal with those smaller systems.
Now, wait a minute before you leave that. 11 FTE for the immediate needing. How many do we have? Do we have?
Are you talking about how many FTE do we have?
Okay, what are we lacking in terms of all these FTEs? You said we don't have the five. What about how many are we short altogether for?
These are all new.
These are all additional capacity that's needed.
We need 11 more for number one, 2.5 for number two, and 5 for number three.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And that's to meet the standards set.
That's to deal with the existing EPA standards. That's to have the capacity just to deal with the 2006 EPA standards, not the possible future ones.
Now, does the federal government fund any of that?
Mr. Chair, they certainly do. They match our state money about 2 to 1.
Oh, okay.
We do not provide enough state money to even maximize the potential federal match. We've gotten it to the point where it's about $250,000, so we're pretty close now. That's the good news.
So is it a 50-50 match or 40-60 or
what? Well, that was a 2-to-1 match.
Okay.
And then it would be is it a 1-to-1 match? They have a formula that's based on the number of systems and geography and the size of those systems.
Okay. So there's no penalty. You have to ask for a waiver, right?
For adopting the new rules?
Well, wait a minute. You don't have enough people to... You are short FTE. You can't match enough to hire the people you need. What penalties are involved, if any?
Mr. Chair, EPA has kind of shaken their postage at us and sent us letters. They sent, I think it was Senator Winters, who chaired the Public Health Committee a couple sessions ago. They sent a letter to the Representative Jensen, who chaired the similar committee on the House side. Frankly, every year we try to negotiate quite clearly with the EPA Region 10 in Seattle how much, given our current resources or anticipated resources, we'll be able to do. And frankly, the only other option is for the EPA to take the program back and just run it as a federal program from their Seattle office as an enforcement penalty effort for these water systems in Oregon. And frankly, in Oregon history, we have given the program back before. We gave it back somewhere around the end of the 80s, and then fairly quickly the legislature and public health decided, you know what, that's not the way to run a public health system, and we adopted primacy again.
But it's still not the way to run a public health system.
I'm sorry, Mr.
I say we're still not running a public health system properly.
No, we're not.
Mr. Chair, if you take the 36, 37 people who work for the state, plus approximately another 14 FTE scattered around the state who are the professionals in all the local health departments, we have the smallest drinking water program of any state in the West.
Okay.
And Idaho, for example, has approximately a third fewer water systems and a third more people dealing with those systems. So if just doing the division between the number of people and the number of systems and the complexity of the issues, that we're just, we're swamped.
And so the need, in addition to the 18.5 additional FTE, is for $3 million per biennium. Are we should we anticipate that this will be part of a budget request looking ahead to the next session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the 18.5 additional county and state public health FTE that I've just identified here as provided from these three sources equals about $3 million a biennium. So it's not 18. I mean, of course we need position authority, but it's not, we need money for 18 and a half people plus we need $3 million. No, the $3 million would help ensure that we can hire the people that we need to do the assurance that we've got. I'll let the public health director talk about the governor's budget.
Well, my philosophy and what I've been urging Lane County to do is give back the programs that the state is refusing to fully fund. That would include the correction program. It would include the AAA program for senior and disabled. That the state said, gee, why don't you do it and we'll give you the money? Well, the state doesn't. So I think that's the easy way out. And if the feds are not, I don't know, maybe we should give it back to the feds and let them do it.
Mr. Chair, if I might, that's a very appropriate response, and I don't mean to make that sound odd, and clearly worthy of consideration.
However, it's
very important to understand all of the implications for that. And frankly, we would be saying no to communities in your district and everywhere else who are accessing these low-cost federal loans. About $24 million a biennium comes into our state to provide those low-cost loans to local communities to build those water facilities, like the one in Sweet Home that I may have mentioned to you before, that simply would not be available. Oregon would not be eligible for it if we did not have primacy.
Okay. That's a good reason to have our own program.
So all I wanted to point out here, of course, you know, A, that we need capacity. Capacity equals people. People equals dollars. And $3 million a biennium, it's not pocket change. It's about a dollar per Oregonian per biennium. I just bought this 20-ounce bottle of water right down the street in Salem for $1.39. Now, as someone who lives in Oregon and drinks water, I could pay another dollar per biennium to provide safe drinking water everywhere in the state, all the campgrounds, all the churches, all the schools, all the gas stations, everywhere. Or I could almost buy one bottle of water. So it's you know, and as the folks in the State Drinking Water Association like to say, only tap water delivers. So
May I get an answer, Mr. Chair, to the question that I raised? I still have the same question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we're taking very seriously what is, I think, both a public health risk and also a risk to our communities to lose access to the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund. So we are seriously raising attention to encourage the state to consider funding this program fully or recognizing the consequences. You were obviously hearing what we are internally proposing be looked at for serious consideration.
As part of the governor's budget. I'm asking a direct question, and I'm just asking for a direct response.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't know what the governor's proposed budget will look like. I am very serious about making a proposal that we take fixing drinking water seriously to anyone who will listen to that discussion. I hope that's more addressing your question.
It is. I think that we may be looking at a different budget environment next session. We may be looking at a different budget environment. And so, you know, if this is an issue that needs to be flagged as for funding, this is the policy committee. I understand that fully. Make it plain to us that that's what we're looking at is the need to request funding to keep the water quality safe. That's what this is about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, if I may follow up with a comment, that I appreciate what you just said. It is because of our expectation of that commitment that we're taking your time today to present this topic. We believe this is very serious. If you asked me what my number one funding proposal would be if I did, you know, if I had a simple path to funding request, it would be for drinking water.
Great.
Okay.
Noted. Thank you.
Just a couple more slides.
To that, though, I really think what Senator Gordley is saying is something that I also believe, and the committee believes, that we are the Public Health Committee, and we want to support your proposal, but we have to know what it is. Mm-hmm. And, if you know, we would like to know what your budget recommendation is going to be for the governor's budget.
Okay.
That's part of what we're doing here. So we want to support you.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that very much. Again, let me assure you, we are only taking your time, this committee's time, with issues that we take very seriously, for which we have an identified need, and we're presenting to you our best concrete definition of what that need is and what we think would improve the health of the public. The Department of Human Services budget process is quite complex, as you well know, so I can't predict where things come out. I can tell you that we're bringing you the serious needs we have identified.
We want to know where things are going in. So tell us how much at some point you're going to be asking for, so we will have some.
We have identified what we think will address the health needs of the state, and you will hear this in other programs from us as well. Thank you. Thank you for this discussion.
That's what you're talking about. Are those the needs, Gail?
Mr. Chair, these are the needs that that have been identified by each of those sources. But if I may, just take a look at, according to the American Society of State Drinking Water Administrators, they identified a state need of approximately $4,000 per public water system per year. Our glass is now about one-third full. We're asking for it to be, we believe that it's necessary for a minimum credible program throughout the state for it to be half full. You'll notice, if I may, that if I can turn right around and keep talking here, that the big issues are the general fund. You notice there's the general fund. Here are the fees at the bottom. We have raised fees administratively and are going through the Senate Bill 333 process. So we are trying to make sure that there is no subsidy involved. If you get this service, then you pay this fee and pay full freight. And you'll also notice that primacy is flat. And you'll also notice that the state revolving fund, 10% set aside, again, that's part of that $24 million a year that we get, that also remains consistent. And so the difference, of course, is that lovely little turquoise block that represents drinking water. I want to stress that this has been identified by a variety of stakeholders throughout the state, the Drinking Water Advisory Committee, the task force, a variety of stakeholder groups individually, as, yeah, we're not willing to pay for, you know, I mean, like bells and whistles, et cetera. But, you know, you don't have a credible program right now. And this is what we believe it will take for a minimum credible program. So, Mr. Chair, this is the policy choice. To authorize through the Senate Bill 333 process our ability to keep those fees. I forgot to include that on the bullet. To allow us to charge a new fee for those on-site inspections that we're simply not able to get to right now. And there was a bill in the session, in the legislature last session to do that. There will be a bill the next session to do that. We believe that it will take additional general funding, and we also have a proposal to establish the Drinking Water Advisory Committee in statute with specific representatives provide the full complement to really focus in on this issue. There is a Drinking Water Advisory Committee now, and they are absolutely fabulous and are doing a terrific job. The Food Service Advisory Committee is in statute. The Emergency Medical Services Committee is in statute. The Trauma Advisory Board is in statute. The Radiation Advisory Committee is in statute. We believe that drinking water is pretty fundamental to public health and deserves that kind of profile in Oregon revised statutes. Or we turn the program to the US EPA. They conduct enforcement only. And among other things, we, as a state, lose access to the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. Pretty clear choices, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat anything. So, who cares about drinking water? Everybody. Where do we get it? Thousands of systems all over the state. How safe is it? Safer than it was. But frankly, these small systems need more help and attention. We want to give it to them, and we can't. So we either build the capacity or cut bait.
Now, I'll try one more time. How much money do we need to keep access to the revolving account? Okay, well, there's a minimum amount, and then there's what? What are we talking about? A range? Are we talking about $3 to $4 million? Are we talking?
I'm not, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
Well,
in order to retain primacy, is that what you're saying?
Okay, the general fund, we're not where we should be in terms of matching funds, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so what would make us, what would be your recommendation for matching funds to receive the federal dollars?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's precisely what the Sanitary Survey Inspection Fee Authority is for. It would raise about $250,000 and allow us to completely max the federal match that we're eligible for.
But to bring the program up to adequacy for the federal terms, please.
Yeah, if you're talking about getting up to everything that we can and should in terms of dollars from the feds, that's what we need. In terms of what we need for a minimum credible program, frankly, if we are not providing the level of oversight that's required by the US EPA, eventually they will just take it away from us.
Okay.
They just will. And we have to negotiate a contract every year. And every year we kind of whittle it down and whittle it down.
Well,
and
give us a ballpark figure.
Mr. Chair, we're looking at about the price of a 20-ounce bottle of water per Oregonian per biennium.
Which is?
$3 million.
Mr. Chair,
I need to clarify something. You're talking about building capacity, and you're talking about small systems. All of Oregon, you have these unincorporated local governments who have no water system. Now, if they are going to, let's take Dune City. You're familiar with that part of the world. Dune City has no water system. Now, if they were going to have a water system, can you imagine the population of Dune City being able to support a water system? They don't have a police force. They don't have a sewage system. Coos Bay North Bend Water Board, when I was chair of the water board, went out to increase our capacity. By the time we got through, it was a $20 million plus facility. I just visited that facility. It's absolutely wonderful.
It's a great system.
It is the most beautiful system, and for the first time it was full. The reservoir was full, and it was just pouring water down. And I went out there, and I was so proud to see it. But I couldn't help but think at the cost of what it was. Now, we have 30 years out in residential supply. That's enviable in this day and time. I mean, there are very few places that a community can say, and that's Coos Bay and North Bend, have a 30-year supply of residential water. But I look around at what Oregon has required of these little groups of people that get together and elect a city council, but that's it. They are not required to have anything else, and that's what you're looking at in those systems.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I hear you, and actually I kind of smiled when you raised Dune City, because that and Bonanza in the south central part of the state are two very striking anomalies that frankly are a problem that nobody so far has found a solution to. I want to make sure that I'm clear. When I'm talking about building capacity, I'm talking about building capacity at the state and local public health force to assure safe drinking water. I am not talking about physical capacity at the Pony
right.
water system or any other water system. That,
okay.
That's a physical capacity, as you point out. I'm talking about people to provide the quality assurance and assistance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, if I may follow on, we're really talking about supporting systems to meet obligations they already have. So what we have now are a lot of systems that are responsible for providing safe water, especially the small systems with people who have less training, less opportunity, less time to do this. We would like to support them to do a better job of meeting current obligations. This is not adding new obligations in that sense. I also, if I may, wanted to link back to the question about security of the water from a terrorist event or so on. There are a couple of reasons not to give the program back to the federal government. The Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund is one. Expecting the federal government to address the needs of people in our state and communities, I think, was somewhat of a question as well. But also, the people we would be adding would be in the health departments as part of the safety monitoring, as part of the emergency response system that Gail mentioned earlier, that we have staff who are working on training and ensuring the safety of the water in every way. So this system actually becomes an additional level of investment in the ability to protect against accidental or deliberate contaminations in the communities in the state.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, indeed.
That's probably a little bit of a harder sell. I'm not going to take everybody's time on a pushback on some of that. But I think that you have a greater problem. Thank you for the clarification on capacity. But you have a greater problem in when you add the people and you're trying to get safe drinking water and you're looking at systems that don't provide it and that don't have the security and the protection of anything infiltrating into it. I mean, I think you could triple the size of the people that you're asking for. And you still haven't gotten to the root of the problem in Oregon with some of these systems.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I don't disagree at all. And certainly that's one where public health may not be the lead partner in addressing. We certainly have expertise and value to add and would be an important piece. But there are a whole variety of, as you know, stakeholders, particularly at the local level in terms of land use, development, zoning, minimum sanitation standards, et cetera, et cetera. I also just wanted to mention to you that you may be familiar with something called ballot measure 37. Not quite sure. Maybe it's an obscure little ballot measure. But frankly, as we look at emerging issues in Oregon in terms of assuring safe drinking water and the cost to the systems to provide that drinking water, because that's their job, it could be that as there are more developments in currently undeveloped areas, agricultural lands, timberlands, et cetera, the movement is not toward individual wells, but rather toward community water systems. So all of a sudden, those community water systems, appropriately, I believe, and I think from a public health standard, need to assure that they are providing safe drinking water. So the number of systems, frankly, is going to continue to grow as additional developments around the state continue to grow.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Well, oh.
Oh.
Yes. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and fellow committee members, if I might make a couple comments about primacy. And remembering back, I was here when Michael Kurtz, Suburban East Salem Water District.
For the record.
Sorry. And I was here in the late 80s managing a system when the feds took over primacy. The state gave it back to the federal government. What I'm looking for out of a agency that provides oversight to me or to our system is a proactive approach. Not necessarily just regulatory. Mm-hmm. We rely on that agency to give us training, assistance, technical assistance, education. I want it to be reliable and consistent. And remembering back and looking to the future, I don't think we'd get that if we turned it back to the federal government. I think we have a reasonable standard there now that meets our needs, but it does not as a system our size. But when you're talking about smaller systems, there's a big gap, and there's a real need for that training and oversight that is being provided or could be provided with adequate funding.
I appreciate that, and I was not aware of the fund that would be at risk from the federal government to develop the smaller systems, and that in itself is reason to keep
it. Mr. Chair, it frankly swamps the dollar amount that we're talking about here.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
And just to be clear, I did not include this information on the slides, but I want to make sure you understand that there is general funding going into state drinking water now. You may recall that bar chart.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is not a total dollar number, but an additional dollar number to add to existing funding that is provided at the state level.
Good luck.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you very much. And I will very embarrassedly and belatedly provide you that handout.
Okay. I do feel, though, that as a public health committee, please keep us informed about your request to the governor's budget. I mean, we should know this. You know, I would appreciate doing the courtesy of giving us some of the information that you're going to be asking through the budget system. We try to marry the policy committees with the budget committees. It doesn't always work that way, but it's kind of ridiculous to have a policy committee getting information and then you go to a budget committee that doesn't get the information and you're looking for support. So we want to support
yes.
you in your effort at the budget end as well. So please keep us informed.
Mr. Chair, I heard that very clearly from several of you. And again, we are bringing to you the issues that we think are those of greatest need. There's a consistency in our policy requests and our now budget requests.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, moving right along. Dr. Allen, if you just... Okay, so Gretchen Morley and Dr. Allen and Thomas Ashenbrenner.
I'll sit here.
Community Health Priorities Project. Okay. Dale, you can stay if you'd like.
Oh, trust me, Mr. Chair, that's quite all right. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Would you like the whole panel to introduce yourself?
Well, go ahead, and then we can do that as you speak.
And I'm going to be giving you just a general overview of the project and let Susan and Thomas provide some additional detail. The reason why we're here is to give you an update, reintroduce you to a project that we talked to you about earlier in the year. At that time, we were calling that project the State of the Health of Oregon Resource. We have changed the name of the project to Community Health Priorities, a Resource for Action in Oregon. And this project is a partnership between the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and the Northwest Health Foundation. The problems that the project is trying to address, I can summarize in three points. One being that we believe the public health suffers from a lack of attention and a lack of understanding and support until a crisis is imminent. in general. The second point I would make is that much of the information that's been collected in public health or that is being collected tends to stay in silos or on the shelves, some very good quality information that doesn't directly filter into the policymaking progress process and program implementation. The other issue that we're trying to address is just, you know, all of us could point to public health needs that we believe are not being addressed adequately, given the extent of the good efforts that are going on. And so what we're trying to do, and just sort of state it broadly, and then as we talk, hopefully it comes down and focus for you, is create a sustained dialogue with the community, being Oregon, to address Oregon's most important health needs in a very rational, prioritized way that's in tune with public will. And like I said, that's kind of the top sort of goal. In the end, the goal is to understand what communities and policymakers care about regarding health, link those concerns with data, and create a resource that propels action to improve the health of Oregonians. As I was saying, a lot of the information that's available stays on shelves and is not immediately available for the policymaking process. Bottom line, we're looking to answer four questions. One, what are Oregon's public health needs? Two, what has been done in the past that has worked, what hasn't worked, and why? How can these past efforts educate future planning and implementation? And how can we effectively build consensus around Oregonians' health priorities? And in other words, how can we build public ownership around how we're going about addressing public health priorities? I think in terms of how we're planning to do this, which I know sounds like a very large project, I'd make a couple general comments about the process that we're embarking on. One is that the process will build on itself. Each stage of the process is defined, educated by the previous process. When you take that approach to a process, it does mean that some later stages are a little ambiguous at this point, as it gets defined by each stage. I think this project is one that can run parallel to public health and healthcare reform discussions that are currently going on. I think nobody wants to hold up anything to do some massive study, nor is that reasonable, and it is completely not our intent. And our hope is that during this process, the project will be making information available along the way that helps with decisions that are being made that affect the health of Oregonians. I think one thing that, as we've talked to groups about this project, one of the biggest concerns that we hear is, are you reinventing the wheel? Are you doing one more survey that's going to end up on the shelves? And I think our whole mindset on this is to not reinvent the wheel, but be essentially educated by the wheel and make the wheel work better. We're not looking to just put one more thing in front of you that you can look at and then put aside. I want to give just an overview of the steps we have at this point of the process and where we are. We are right now at step one, which is looking at previous projects that have been done, looking at previous community engagement processes that to identify the most effective way of communicating with Oregonians and the lessons learned from those projects. Right now, we have staff from each of our organizations doing an analysis of reports and talking to people who were involved in those previous processes to learn what was learned by those projects.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a question here while it's still with me? Is there a list of the previous projects that you're looking at and people that you're talking with? Yeah, I'll just start there. Does that exist?
We do. We can get that for you.
Yeah. Give it to the administrator so we'll all have that.
We'll do that. The first step is looking at these previous projects. Our hope is to have that segment of the process of the project done by the end of July. So that should be something by the end of the summer that we should be able to filter back to you.
Okay.
The other part of the question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair,
mm-hmm.
is it strictly public health? Is that inclusive of mental health?
We're focusing on the health of the public, as I just heard Susan say, and so there are a number of both public health, health care, I'd have to look at the list to see if there's anything specific on mental health. Unless
Mr. Chair, if I may, Susan Allen, State Public Health Director, and part of the triumvirate of managing this process. This project is deliberately as casting as wide a net as possible. One of the striking things is that when you talk to people and communities about health issues, you know, those of us who do the system day to day start thinking about access to medical care. Communities often think about things like vermin control, pedestrian safety, safety of children in the schools, health education. So communities have a much more robust and probably appropriate sense of what affects their health. So we're trying to be as open-ended as possible so we can ask communities what they think the health-related features are. We're saying public health to try to create a vision that it's not medical care, that it's anything that people think affects the health in their communities or their families.
So it could include mental health.
I would be surprised if it did not include mental health.
Well, as chair of the Public Health Committee, I feel that everything comes under public health, all health issues. Really, it does. I mean, we're talking, you know, you just mentioned all sorts of things that are important to communities, vermin control, and so on, and yeah.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate your perspective.
Yes. Okay.
So our next step, after looking at past lessons, is to take the lessons learned from that first step and put it into a step where we're going to hopefully find a way to engage the community in a dialogue. Right now, what we're envisioning is a dialogue that would determine their public health concerns and how they would prioritize and want them addressed. We are currently planning on interviewing with legislators and other policymakers and other community leaders sometime around September, followed by public opinion polling sometime early fall.
Wow.
So that is step two. Step three and four go hand in hand, and we're thinking towards the end of the year, which step three is synthesizing what we hear from the communities with the with currently available public health data and reports. So this is also where some of the past information plus current data sources get married with what we learn from the community. Step four is planning and implementing a strategy for communicating those findings. And that's where I think when we talked to you before, some of the questions were, are you talking about a report? Are you talking about a website? And the question could be, the answer to that is probably. And I think that's depending on what the information starts to look like. And as we go along, I think there's going to be quite a bit of brainstorming. And what's an effective way to make information available to both the community, to policymakers, to funders? I mean, what formats work to keep information alive? And as we go forward, if in subsequent years, if we continue this process, something that can keep the information available.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Gretchen, what was the genesis of this idea? In other words, why are you jumping through these hoops? Is it, you said public health lacks understanding. Do you think it's to the degree that people simply have a total disconnect from what public health does or what they should do?
Susan, would you like to start it up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, there are a couple of things that came together last year in terms of discussion and concern. One of them was a sense that a lot of funding energy and a lot of attention is going to items that probably are not the most important for the health of most communities. So we may have across this country a disconnect between what actually improves health and what the attention has been going to. A second theme is a sense, and that gets to people focusing on medical care, basically fixing themselves when they're broken versus keeping themselves healthy or living in communities in ways that help make people healthy. A second thing, I was last year new to the state, still getting my bearings here, and it was striking how many different task forces, committees, plans had been developed that were on the shelf in my office, and nothing had happened after them. And a lot of hard work and committed people had been involved,
right.
And it hit a wall. So my question was, why did it hit a wall? Why, after that much concern and effort, did it stop? So part of what Gretchen identified in the process we're working with is asking people. You were involved in this process. People were committed. They cared. And yet it didn't turn into action. It didn't actually end up making people healthier. What stopped it? To see if once we understand what stopped it, we could avoid that pitfall. At the same time, there are a handful of things that were successful. And why were they successful in Oregon with the people, with the policymakers of this state? And to understand what moves to an actual change, moves to a momentum. And then the third thing is that there are so many issues on my plate and yours. And they're not all equally important, or they're not all equally ripe for making better. And we hope this process, by looking at the data, but also what people care about, helps us identify those things that are at a point of sufficient importance and sufficient commitment to move ahead, so that, you know, I'm not going to stop any of the things that are in my job responsibility in public health as an agency. But if you look at public health as kind of a larger question, a larger field, there may be other things, and I don't know if it's meth or early childhood intervention or community-based adolescent services. I don't know what will come out. But if we get 3 or 5 or 7 priorities that really rise to the top, I hope that with the dialogue we're having, then with the number of people involved, maybe we could actually make some people healthier.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
it was a good response. I wonder if you'd tell me what you think the priorities are right now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Virgin, you mean with respect to what we're operationalizing, or what I think
you would like to get a list of priorities to come out of this,
right,
as to what you could focus on and do some analysis. I like analysis. I don't like analysis paralysis. I think that's a really serious thing in government. We have a lot of that. But I'm intrigued at a group that are just kind of taking time out and saying, okay, we need to go back to square one and figure out now and go out and get input and then come up with the priorities. So I'm not offended by any of that, but I wonder what are your you're new, but when you came onto the job, what did they have as some of the priorities for the public health?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, took a simplistic approach and said that you can see where people's priorities are by where they put their money, which I think has some truth to it.
Right.
We're putting it into end-stage disease. We put it into Medicaid. We put it into long-term care after people are no longer able to take care of themselves. We're putting it into state hospitals for the mentally ill who are no longer able to function in communities. We're putting it into various kinds of substance abuse, frequently after people have been arrested. So the things that we're not doing, and in fact, if you asked what my public health priorities would be, they would almost be 180 degrees from there. I would invest in early childhood programs. I would invest in community environmental health, in health education, in adolescent risk reduction services, in early intervention for people with mental illnesses, and with a lot of self-education and active case management for people who have chronic diseases or new diseases. They actually need social workers and nurses a lot more than they need renal specialists frequently. So I think that probably if we said what we want to do is make the communities healthier, we'd probably spend money literally 180 degrees from where we as a nation as well as a state are putting our money.
On prevention.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. It was a very good response.
One of the reasons that I don't think these things ever go anywhere is that you don't end up with timeline for implementation so people can track them over a period of time. So I'm hoping that your priorities will have implementation times that keeps them alive. Otherwise, it's another report on the shelf. I'm sorry.
Well, actually, you're right on the point that I want to ask about. I appreciate the four questions that you are posing, but it seems to me that you're leaving one out. Why not ask directly, again, going to your point about all the plans you found on your shelf when you arrived? It seems to me we need to be asking directly the question, why have plans not been implemented?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the actual the interview process of the key informants includes a great many questions to get exactly to the point you just suggested. In some ways, why did things not happen or why did they happen are the two most critical issues. And our interviewers, representing the staff from our three organizations, are asking that from every possible direction. So these are the large questions that we're getting to. The actual interviews are collecting that.
So we're getting at why there has been a failure to implement whatever it was.
Or a success.
Mm-hmm. But again, I'm focusing on the reports that are on the shelf. Mm-hmm. Some have more dust than others. You know, what does that failure piece look like? Why is that? And then also, what are the leadership questions, quality of leadership questions or capacity questions within that? I'm thinking, for example, two governors put together two different mental health task forces with different charges. Did good work. Some things are on track to be implemented. Other things have fallen by the wayside. Will your process look at those reports, for example, and ask those deep kinds of questions of those folks who participated on those two different task forces? The Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force is another example of a report that is on the shelf in some places, but in other places the report's open, very much open. But there are questions about leadership and whether there's support for the policy issues that were surfaced in the reports. I'm trying to get a sense of how you'll drill down to that level of questioning and unpacking what's there, and how is that going to be different from other efforts that have attempted to do the very same thing.
If I may introduce the third of our triumvirate here, because I think that the presence of the Northwest Health Foundation and Thomas Aschenbrenner is part of why this may be different. And Mr. Chair, if I may come back, actually you made a point about what our priorities, like they would be ours. My proposal is that if we do this process, we as a collective do this right, they will be everybody's priorities and not this project's or this team's priorities. But one of the things to keep us, I hope, out of the analysis paralysis that government can fall into, and I have certain, when I have my full work hat on, I have lots of boundaries and parameters and restrictions, as you are well aware. But we represent different approaches, and I think the Oregon Health Policy Commission brings a policy perspective and freedom that is different from what public health in DHS brings. And even more broadening for us is the involvement of the Northwest Health Foundation, and Thomas Aschenbrenner, their executive director here, has, I think, helps bring in a different approach, and in particular has committed the staff who are managing a lot of the day-to-day processes about which Senator Gordley, you were just asking. So I would like, if Thomas doesn't mind, to invite him to talk a little about that process.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Aschenbrenner. I'm president of Northwest Health Foundation, foundation that has been funding programs in health in Oregon since 1997. When Dr. Allen and I first had conversation about this, it became clear that both of us shared a great frustration with those projects that had indeed remained on the shelf and or been where we saw that there were very good recommendations that were going nowhere. And it was a question of what can we do that is indeed a different approach. Forming the public-private partnership with Oregon Health Policy Commission, DHS, and Northwest Health Foundation is one way that we think that we're setting a new model for doing something a little differently. There are many things, as Dr. Allen alluded to, that simply because of being a government employee and part of the system, she cannot do. Same is true for Ms. Morley and the Policy Commission. But Northwest Health Foundation can do some things like we can devote some staff time to coordination. We can go out and hire someone, as we have, to do some of the policy analysis. We can go and hire the political strategists who can come in and advise us on how to use the words most effectively. We can do the polling and key informant interviews that are very hard to access if you are coming out of some of the other systems. All of this has to lead, however, to a point in time where we say, what is it going to take to educate the community to get to social change, social valuing of these issues? Probably the biggest barrier I see in what it is that has not happened as the result of some of this good information is that we have not taken advantage of educating the public so that the community and social values support those recommendations. And that's one of the things that I think we would like to try and be there to help advance some of these ideas. So let me leave it at that at this point.
Well, I was very close to the end of my prepared remarks. I think getting to what Thomas just said, I went through four steps before. Step five was is sort of the through 2007 and beyond, with the hope that this project and ongoing work like this, assists in the development of policy recommendations and formulation of the policy agenda of the state around improving the health of Oregonians. I think that was my last prepared comment. We'd like to see what other questions you might have and other other pieces of input you might like to give us while we're here.
I think we raised a lot of questions mm-hmm. along the way. We are a little bit over time, but we will take as much time as it.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, about the Oregon benchmarks and whether the benchmarks will also inform your methodology, your process.
And when you say Oregon benchmarks, is that the progress board?
Yes.
Okay. Then that is one of the processes on the list, or the projects on the list that's being looked at.
I guess I'm really impressed with your participation in this private sector participation, because you can do some things that can't be done otherwise in terms of staffing, doing the surveys, doing a lot of the essential work to make something continue. The analogy that I heard when I was on a governor's task force on supporting higher ed and tuition and so on was it wasn't on the shelf. It was a Gail Shibley analogy of dropping it down the well, never to be seen again. I mean, there are a lot of reports that are on a shelf or put away somewhere, and mm-hmm. you never ever see them again. And so I was thinking at the time that there, if you don't have timelines to continue and benchmarking, I think that you're going to achieve this in certain periods of time, and so there's a reason to come back and look at it. Someone can say, hey, it's now 2009 and we're supposed to have achieved this and we haven't, why haven't we? So I think there's got to be a built-in mechanism to review as part of the final report and the implementation. You come up with the report and then implementing it and the continuum. So I think that, I hope that would be part of it.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that is what we can do through the Northwest Health Foundation that is very difficult to do through the traditional government entities. And I should say that we have had from our inception a very good working relationship with both DHS and the local public health agencies in the state. As you may know, it is not common for a foundation to be funding governmental agencies, and from the very beginning we took that on and recognized that we could play a valuable role in doing that. And so that this is a continuation of those previous successes and trying something new and different that we are very optimistic can set the standard, if you will, for how we as Oregonians can move forward.
Great. I think it's wonderful. Thank you very much for being part of it.
Okay. Any other questions?
You have a question? Forget it.
Okay, it's about education accountability, but that was okay. two committees today. So
the university's involved? We have not.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, the universities are involved in that they were involved in many of the studies that had been conducted. We have had, I am truly amazed at a couple of things. One, the willingness on the part of the people who were the key participants in those studies to talk with us and share information very, very genuinely. And not only what that study was, but what their conclusions are since those studies ended and what they've seen happen. It has been very good. We are not including the universities at this time in our work directly because it seems to be the step down the road. Arguably, we will come up with what are the gaps in information, and that's when we need to figure out who can give us the answers to those gaps and how do we define it for them to do that. So I think there is a role in the past, and there was a role in the past, and there will be a role in the future, but right now we're trying to define what are the issues that we need to be working on.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, oral health. Kathleen Bradley? Yes.
I'm thirsty.
Oh. Kathleen Bradley.
Yes, sir. If I can get back here. Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm Kathleen Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, which houses the oral health program. With me today, I also have Dr. Gordon Empey. He's a consultant to our program and functions ostensibly in the role of state oral health officer. And what we want to do is do a brief presentation for you today on the current status of our children's oral health program, what are some of the challenges, what we're doing around prevention, and the state plan. I think you have a couple of handouts in front of you, and the handouts will be the state plan, a little bit about dental sealants, because that's new for many of us that did not have that when we were young and growing up, and then just a quick overview of the program. The problem that I'm just briefly outlining here, we've got other detailed materials that many of you are familiar with, but specifically when we're speaking to children's issues, over 50% of Oregon school-aged children currently have problems with dental decay. This information is predominantly based on our surveys that were done several years ago, known as our SMILE survey, where we actually went into our schools in Oregon and did actual evaluation and assessment of first through third graders. Of that, the issue of health disparities continues to be an exceedingly strong strong issue. One in five low-income children have rampant dental decay. The term rampant dental decay, which is hard to understand, is actually they have seven or more cavities at the given time of actually having their mouths inspected, which is kind of an incredible thought in terms of thinking about number of cavities in a child between first and third grade. And 90% of children's dental decay occurs in the molars. That's an important concept just to understand actually what part of the mouth needs to be protected and part of our prevention work that's ongoing. This is one of the slides that we have set up, and in most of these, the way we've designed it is if you look at the red is either Oregon or the point that we're trying to make. Here is the one that demonstrates that Oregon's children have more dental decay. We're at 56%. The U.S. is at 52% in blue, and Healthy People 2010, which is our federal goals, are at 42%. So you can see the intrinsic issue we have in terms of children in Oregon. Oral health disparities continues to be a core issue that we are struggling with across many different areas, and in oral health it is equally as dominant. Again, what we have here in red is actually representative of low income because it's school children that are attending schools that for free or reduced lunch program, so they represent low income. So they are more likely to have decay, more likely to have decay in seven or more teeth, untreated decay and needing treatment. And again, I think that second bar of 21% of decay in seven or more teeth is one that is extremely hard to imagine. What I wanted to do is identify the two active programs that we have going on at our state and local levels around prevention. The first one is fluoride varnish. That would be considered to be a promising health practice. It's used predominantly with infants between the ages of 6 and 24 months. We've got it in about a third of our counties that actually have it as part of a comprehensive program. So public health nurses who are doing home visits are able to assess children on the basis of protocols that have been developed, and then are on the basis of that assessment able to apply a fluoride varnish to the front teeth of those children, and it's shown to be very effective if done within a 12-month period. So this is one of those very early intervention components in terms of trying to work with young children's that's an incorporation of public health. The other component of that that's key then is obviously a recommendation into a dental home and integration into the dental community for ongoing dental care. But the one that we're most effectively focused on is our school-based dental sealant program. And I did provide you just a little one-page handout on dental sealants. That was not a program that was available when we were younger and growing up. It is very much the standard of care today. If a family does have a dental home, does have a dentist, does have dental health insurance, the likelihood is very high that they will have dental sealants on their teeth. It's applied to the molars. So if you think of it, what we said earlier, 90% of children's cavities occur in the back molars, which come in when their permanent teeth come in. So you're looking about 6 to 8 year olds. And so the most effective way that we found that we can actually reach those children who don't necessarily have health care insurance is to go through the schools. What we fostered from the state level with CDC dollars, we've been able to work on communities that have been really engaged in school-based varnish programs, which they go in and they actually evaluate and assess the children, and then, sealants. Thank you. The sealant program, and actually apply it. It's actually a plastic coating to the molars that lasts for up to about 10 years, and it's extremely effective. It's cost-effective in that the cost of being able to do that, we can do about 4 children with dental sealants for the cost of 1 cavity being repaired. It's well supported and it's non-controversial. It's supported certainly by the American Dental Association, but it's not been an issue of controversy for any of our public or private partners. And again, it really can be applied across all children. And with our school-based programs, which has been our real focus, that is where we're able to sort of reach the students who normally would not have access.
Ms. Chair?
Yes.
Why just molars?
The reason is that 90% of your cavities occur in the molars.
I understand that, but if...
And if I can demonstrate maybe with this picture, we tried to produce some somewhat aesthetic pictures. As you'll see, there are grooves in the molars where bacteria tend to collect, and by then putting a sealant on that molar, you're actually able to protect the predominance of the cavities.
I guess, Ms. Chair, just a matter of if we're dealing with people with poor hygiene skills, wouldn't have seen it on everything, kind of take care of.
Maybe I can jump in here. My name is Gordon Empey. I'm a dental health consultant to the Office of Family Health, and Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz. Evidence, we follow evidence-based practices as closely as we can, and evidence does not indicate the placement of sealants on other teeth is an effective, cost-effective strategy, but placing them on molars is. So that's why we limit it to molars, particularly from a public health perspective where we have to be cognizant of costs. So that's the primary reason. It's just not, there just isn't any evidence that it actually reduces decay significantly in other teeth.
Okay, thank you.
This chart demonstrates what we showed you, what I was speaking to earlier, but what are the factors that influence whether 8-year-olds have sealants or not? And again, in the red, what that reflects are children who are non-white, who are low-income, do not have dental insurance coverage, or do not have English as their primary language. So as you can see, automatically that presents a disadvantage in terms of health disparity and the likelihood of receiving sealants. The main limitation we have currently with our sealant program is the amount of funding that we have. We've been able to do it with CDC funding. The community programs that we're engaged in is that we have 4 communities a year that we identify that we provide technical assistance with from the state level, and then that then is used by those communities to identify how to work with their local community and dental community and work with the schools in terms of setting up a program. This one does require a dentist and a hygienist to be involved because the dentist does the original or the actual assessment and the hygienist does the application. We now have over 27 communities that are involved with this, and we have another 17 that are on a list of interest that want to be engaged with this further. And we have been commended by the CDC on our community-based approach that we're engaged in. The other thing I wanted to mention, because we certainly can't talk about oral health without mentioning fluoride, and wanted to bring up the issue again about fluoridation. We've had that discussed frequently previously in this committee and will in the future. Oregonians that have fluoridated water, run at about 19% on any sort of oral health report cards across the board for Oregon. They continue to get an F in terms of fluoridated water. And again, what we're doing with prevention in terms of dental sealants really is an aspect of trying to also sort of deal with the issue that we have. The majority of Oregonians do not have access to fluoridated water. And then just in terms of attention to your time, the next steps that we have going on with our oral health program are several. Ongoing technical assistance with our dental sealant program. We do want to bring attention to you specifically the statewide plan for oral health, which you have in your hands. This is really the result of 3 years of very consistent work and funding from the CDC. We had an oral health coalition meeting on May 12th. We had over 137 public and private partners there. It was the first time in Oregon that we actually had that kind of involvement and attendance, and was viewed as being a tremendous amount of energy and excitement about moving ahead in terms of actual implementation of the state oral health plan. From that coalition, the next day there was a meeting of about 35 core members that represent a variety of communities. There are 4 subcommittees that have been formed. There are specific goals and outcomes that are being designed to achieve. There are actually guidelines that are going to be published as a second document that should be ready in about a month. There are specific implementation strategies along with a separate, what we're calling a burden document, which has our data. But we'll be able to provide for you in the future an ongoing update. But for the oral health community in particular, this really is seen as an opportunity to really mobilize and organize the work of more oral health and integrate it into the rest of the healthcare community work, and not to have it run as a separate vehicle. And then the last is that we are going to have a follow-up on our SMILE survey in 2007, this next year, and that's the survey that we do with young children every 5 years, where we actually go in and assess the oral health of first through third graders. And so we'll have updated information next year. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could you tell me the percent of people, again, I think you said it, but I didn't get the right number. the number of people in Oregon, the number of children who have access to fluoridated water?
It's not just the number of children, it is the number of Oregonians. Oregon currently ranks 46th in the country, and a little over 20% of our population is served by community water systems that have optimally fluoridated water. So it's a little over 20% currently.
And can you explain that to me a little bit, why that is?
I think the issue of fluoridation in Oregon has been one that has been an issue of intense controversy. When we speak about it from a public health perspective, what we look at is the science and the background behind that, which seems to demonstrate that there's a 50-year history that fluoridation is the most effective and cost-effective way to prevent cavities and promote oral health. There has been concern, though, from other members within our Oregon community about other concerns and the implications, I think, of adding what is perceived to be another chemical additive to our water system. From a public health perspective, we're pretty clear that the research continues to demonstrate a longstanding critical need for it. And again, in Oregon, it's interesting that so much of our work continues to move towards prevention measures, where we're very desperately trying to reach children and adults with prevention measures that are partially the result of the fact that we do not have adequately fluoridated systems. And I know Dr. Empey could speak further if you have more questions.
I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Isn't it true also that the Dental Association and the hygienist and those all support fluoridation?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berger, yes. There is currently a coalition that I have the opportunity to attend on a regular basis that is concerned about Oregon and the lack of fluoridation. And in that coalition, it's a very broad base consisting of all the healthcare organizations as well as other private and public sector partners.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So can you tell me why we have failed to convince 80% of Argonians that it's a bad idea?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, I'm a public health official, and I cannot explain that, given the fact that 67% of the nation currently has the benefits of drinking fluoridated water, compared to only 19% or 21% here in Oregon, depending on which figure you use. I'm just at a loss to know why that is. I do know that fluoridation has been, over the decades, has been slower to be approved by our communities and our people in the western part of the United States. But most recently, we've seen huge increases in that with California adopting a statewide mandatory fluoride law, and large cities like San Antonio, Texas, and Salt Lake City fluoridating. So it's a growing, I think, increase in the number of people who are drinking fluoridated water in the West, as well as what we've seen in the East over the last five decades.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verdick, actually one of the other things Dr. Allen so kindly reminded me of, but I do think it's important. One of the expressions that we try and use is that with oral health, what we're trying to do is put the mouth back into the body. I think with fluoridation, it's often viewed as a cosmetic effect, not as a health effect, and I don't think there's been as much recognition of the impact of oral health and its effect on chronic disease and one's physical health over time. And so when people talk about fluoridation and its side effects, it's viewed really less as a health effect than a cosmetic. And I think if we begin to have a better understanding of the real implications of good oral hygiene and its effect on chronic disease, that might help that understanding and discussion.
Mr. Chair, just one. I guess that's right. I have a hard time understanding that reasoning, however, because cavities and gum disease and all of those things going into the blood system are certainly bad for you. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a real strong connection, but I appreciate your allowing me to pursue this thing, because it just has always been, I've been kind of nonplussed at it since I've lived in Oregon. So
Can I just make one final comment, Mr. Chair and Senator Berger? That is that we see dental disease is a very complex disease and requires multi ways in which to deal with them in terms of strategies. Water fluoridation is only one. That's why we brought forth other kinds of community-based strategies that are needed. It doesn't take away still our ultimate responsibility to visit a dentist on a regular basis, proper oral hygiene, nutrition, et cetera. But these community-based strategies that we talk about are a way to get at the disparities in oral health.
Senator.
Do you know if all of the children involved in Oregon's pre-kindergarten program or Head Start participate in the Sealant program?
I'll answer that, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley. Sealants, because they're targeted at six-year molars, usually we don't see six-year molars in the kindergarten kids, so we target the second graders. That's the grade we normally target with our school-based sealant programs.
And the follow-up to that, I was looking back at the slide that describes the eight-year-olds who received the sealants. Tell me if I'm reading this correctly, that 44% of all of the white eight-year-olds have sealants. That's all eight-year-olds in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Is that how I can read that?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Berkow,
two questions.
Yes.
Thank you. A few months ago, the CDC came out with a report, something to the effect of the amount of fluoride in water. I don't know if it's controversial or what was the end result of that, or was there, in terms of fluoride in water
Chair.
Here?
That was the EPA, as its normal course of business, does regulate additives to the water, and they require every so many years to bring together task forces to look at additives to the water and make recommendations. This particular report was an NCR report to the EPA on the fluoride additive and what the maximum contaminant level of fluoride should be. We know that fluoride, when added to the water, it has decay preventive benefits, but also if it's above a certain level, it actually can have health effects. And so this report was a report to EPA on that. And I'd be happy to, it's quite complex, and I'd be happy to follow that up with some discussion. But the answer to your question is that EPA is currently reviewing those recommendations and will come out with potential changes to maximum contaminant level for drinking water systems.
Yeah. Second question.
Yes.
Thank you. And this is several years ago, I attended a rural health coordinating council meeting, and a dentist from the rural areas there, and he was talking some of the effect of mothers with newborns and passing along dental disease or resistance.
Yes.
Can you address that?
We now know that that dental decay is an infectious disease, and the bacteria that causes that infection is passed on from mother to child in the first 2 years of life. So that's why many of our programs, even though we talked about fluoride varnish targeting the very young children, those programs, which are called early childhood cavities prevention programs, we also charge the look at the pregnant women as well by advocating access to care so that we can reduce those bacteria in those mothers, and we can provide and have that opportunity to educate the mother on that transmission of bacteria.
That was a good question. I also heard that at a conference that I attended, the whole oral health and the fact that mothers do pass on some of these things. It's a bacteria?
Mr. Chair, several bacteria actually
Is that
contribute.
Passed through the system?
Actually, it's passing the saliva from mother to child.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, other questions? Do we have a... Go ahead.
Well, several years ago, we did have a state dental health director, Dr. Payne, Whitney Payne, and it seems like when he left, we no longer have one. Was it a restructured public health department, or what?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the question. We do technically have a position for a lead dental health officer. Unfortunately, we do not technically have one for a state dental health officer in our current HR system, and we are working on that. In the meantime, what we've done is we have contracted with Dr. Empey to fill that role for us.
Susan, did you have something you want to add to that? You got to come up here. For the record.
Susan Allen, State Public Health Director. There are a number of challenges in our public health system for positions that are highly trained and highly technical. The salary ranges are frequently not adequate to allow us to fill the positions.
Okay. So you work cheap, right?
As it turned out.
Thank you for taking that on. We appreciate it.
Comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Having had the privilege of growing up where natural fluoridation was available, I had no cavities until age 60, and because of poor education, didn't visit my dentist but twice until I was 50 years old. Mm. But fluoridation does work.
So is that a genetic
No, what's
thing?
Fluoridation?
Fluoridation, okay. So that's
natural fluoridation in the water.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, thank you very much for all of you being here today. Unless we have further business, we will...